Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues produced by the Haag Foundation for Mental Health. The Haag Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, a podcast on mental health issues. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we're talking about Indigenous mental health. Thanksgiving is just a couple days away, and we all know the cliches. Feasting, football, tense conversations with family, drinking, tense conversations combined with drinking, drinking combined with football, and maybe something in there about giving thanks. But you get it, right? One other thing that is in danger of becoming its own cliche is the particular meaning that Thanksgiving holds for Indigenous Americans. By cliche, what I mean is that many people are aware that Thanksgiving is, at some level, problematic for Indigenous people. But I want to be very clear. For many Indigenous Americans, Thanksgiving is not simply problematic. In fact, it commemorates genocide, dispossession, forced removal, cultural genocide, acts of cultural erasure, large and small. It's an emotional gauntlet, is what I am saying, with mental health implications that are worth discussing. Angela Vela Arce is a master's student at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work. She was also recently director of the Native American and Indigenous Collective, which is part of the Multicultural Engagement Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Angela, thanks for joining us. So I am going to be interviewing another expert on Indigenous mental health, hopefully, and that's Holly Echo Hawk, a former member of our NAC, National Advisory Council, which I'm looking forward to. But I reached out to you because I wanted to add another layer of perspective, you know, that focuses more on younger adults. So one question that I have is, what continuities and differences can you see across generations of Indigenous communities, you know, as it pertains to mental health?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that question. And I'm very flattered that you would consider me an expert. I would say that I'm the expert of my own lived experience, but I'm definitely learning and in a stage of learning how to be a good clinician to the communities that I want to serve and that I currently serve, which definitely includes Indigenous communities and Indigenous youth. One thing that I'm particularly interested in is serving different intersections of our communities. So I noticed that over the course of several years, at least in Texas, or the land that's now called Texas, right now we're on Comanche and Gwahuiltecan land, I would say that there is an awakening in youth who want to learn more about their heritage and where they come from, especially youth who have identified as Hispanic or Latinx or Mexican, Mexican-American their whole lives. So that is something that I'm seeing in partnership with the Indigenous Cultures Institute. So we have elders, Dr. Garza, Dr. Mario Garza, and Maria Rocha, who are the executive directors of that institute and work with Indigenous youth ages anywhere between 5 to in their 20s, like myself, to work with them to understand, to help them understand where exactly their origins are, where they come from. A lot of Indigenous youth or youth who may identify as Hispanic or Latinx experience Indigenous diaspora or displacement or detribalization. What it means is that we, after settler colonialism, and settler colonialism is still happening, have been removed forcibly from our homelands or forced to migrate to different places. As a result, we may not really know where our tribes are, where we come from exactly. And so the experience that I'm coming from is within the Texas-Mexico borderlands. So I can't really speak too much for communities outside of where I come from, but also I notice that there's this very big development, big issue that's happening here in Texas, where youth are looking to reclaim and express their indigeneity and their indigenous heritage.
So tell us a little bit more about yourself and what personal moments or milestones led to your interest in social work and this particular mode of practice.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I never really thought I would go into social work ever in my life. Not because I didn't value social work, but because I didn't really understand it. And so many of my peers at the School of Social Work didn't realize how broad and how many opportunities there were in social work. You could be a medical social worker. There are social workers for veterinarians. You can do anything in social work. When I went to the University of Texas as an undergraduate, I initially started in English as a double major in English, Mexican American Latinx Studies, with a certificate in Native American Indigenous Studies, and was in an honors program. I initially thought maybe, okay, I could go into law school and do immigration law, or I was going to get my PhD in English literature. But more and more, I started becoming so interested in how health was represented in our stories by Indigenous authors and Mexican American authors and Latinx authors from different places. And so I started to question, okay, well, what does this mean? Why are we talking so much about healing and illness? I read Gloria Anzaldúa's Borderlands when I was 19, and I thought it was so fascinating how she described the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, as an open wound, and how that, you know, segregation, how that border also influenced violence and influenced, you know, mental health issues, issues that are salient across the borderlands. So I thought, okay, well, this is something that I'm really interested in, but I want to take it beyond literature. How does storytelling influence medical practices and healer-patient relationships and clinician relationships? And so I thought that was one of the richest places and questions that I could ask. So I thought more and more about my upbringing and realized how important indigenous medicine and curanderismo was to me. And my grandmother, who comes from this small community called Dolores de las Minas, which is north of Laredo, an indigenous community, I realized how much indigenous values and teachings that she gave me throughout my life, and how much they were centered on the health and well-being of people, helping people, healing people. And first, I didn't realize that I could make that into a profession. And then I found out, okay, well, I could actually do this as a social worker after talking to people at the Multicultural Engagement Center, so staff that work there, people who are licensed masters of social workers.
So how welcoming is the campus environment for Native American or Indigenous students? How would you assess the campus climate in general? I'm also interested in your work for the Native American and Indigenous collective, if you don't mind sharing.
Mm-hmm. There is certainly a gap in services for Indigenous students, and there is a gap in services provided, because I think that there's also a misconception or maybe a lack of understanding of who is Indigenous on campus. So for students like myself and a vast array of students who come from the borderlands across Turtle Island, so what's now called the United States, or Abya Yala, so like South America, or across Latin America, in other words, a lot of students aren't actually considered Indigenous by the institution, even though we are. Being Indigenous means that we have a special relationship with a people and with a homeland and with a community. One disparity, I would say, is we really do not have a space for Indigenous students, a center. I think that some improvements I am seeing is that we now have a major that includes Indigenous Studies. So we do have a program, a certificate program, the Native American Indigenous Program, Indigenous Studies Program, sorry, that is directed currently by Dr. Carcamo Vicente. And now we have a major, I think, that is race, migration, and indigeneity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in terms of mental health, we really don't have a specific group counseling session for Indigenous students, and that's something that I would like to see happen. In other words, we have Latinx voices where students who identify as Latinx can come and discuss things that they're experiencing or process issues that they're experiencing, whether it's related to contemporary events or their identities or both, because both can always obviously intersect. But for Native students, it's not, we don't really have that space to be in a group and process our emotions that way. And I think that that's also why organizations like the Native American Indigenous Collective is so important, because one student-led, youth-led organization that makes community happen. Also, of the campus environment for Indigenous students, I think it's important to acknowledge that there also is an undocumented community at the University of Texas at Austin. And there's excellent organizations as well. That would include the Native American Indigenous Collective, that we're inclusive and intersectional. I think that there's also the University Leadership Initiative. And students who are undocumented, a lot of students, I think we also need to acknowledge that many undocumented students also identify as Indigenous or have Indigenous communities or Indigenous heritage that they should be able to express and feel free to understand and know and claim.
So if time had permitted, I might have tried to do this episode during Columbus Day, just because it brings to the forefront a lot of the same issues as Thanksgiving, but without even having the more socially redeeming, in my opinion, qualities of Thanksgiving. In prior episodes, we've talked about historical and cultural trauma, mostly in the context of African-American mental health. Do these issues find their way into your work or your day-to-day, you know, especially around this time of year?
I would say that there is, I definitely want to address that there is intergenerational trauma in Indigenous communities. And I think that the field of epigenetics and the studies of epigenetics is really coming to the fore right now. However, even though science or Western science says this is something that we're studying and these are new findings, I think that we've always known this to be true, that our communities have experienced intergenerational trauma as a result of settler colonialism, as a result of our, you know, mistreatment and oppression, and how the United States government has been, you know, complicit and active in that treatment and oppression of Indigenous peoples and violence against Indigenous peoples. And so that's still ongoing. I think that we tend to think of settler colonialism and trauma as having happened so many centuries ago, and it's no longer relevant. And I would really encourage the listeners and people in general and society in general to think beyond that and to critically interrogate what it means to experience intergenerational trauma, especially from a person of color's perspective and especially from Indigenous people's perspectives. During Thanksgiving time, I'm reminded of when there was water protectors at Standing Rock on Thanksgiving. I don't know if you remember what happened, but there was police hosing down Indigenous peoples and mm-hmm. allies, and it was all recorded on tape, the violence that was happening to the Standing Rock community, and that was happening exactly on Thanksgiving. And so that's something that we shouldn't forget, that's part of a larger structure of how Indigenous peoples and our environment are, you know, extracted from and experience violence. So I think that these things do come up for Indigenous peoples across what's now called North America, and especially in the United States, that even beyond Thanksgiving, there are constant reminders of how intergenerational trauma exists within our communities because we experience it daily. Around this time of year, what I also see is that is currently happening, I think it's important to acknowledge that the undocumented community is experiencing violence and dehumanization, both in detention, facing threat of deportation, and also the increase in fees for applying for DACA and asylum. And
Supreme Court's getting ready to rule.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that that would be happening this time of year.
Yeah.
The National Day of Mourning has existed, I think, since the 70s as an alternative to Thanksgiving. And that gets me thinking that mourning has a therapeutic dimension, but also in this case, a resistance dimension. Is that something that you have any thoughts on or any connection to?
Yes, I do. And this gives me an opportunity to discuss my clinical skills. So,
please.
Well, yeah, I have been learning a lot about grieving, grief and loss, and what society considers legitimate forms of grieving or legitimate forms of loss. I think as a society within the United States, within what's now called the United States, we really do tend to turn our heads away from grief and death and don't want to talk about it. But for some communities and for some people, this is an everyday part of our lives where our communities have experienced so much displacement and so much violence and oppression that these are things, a part of our everyday lives that we can't really avoid. And in terms of loss, of course, I think there are different experiences with death loss in Indigenous communities. I think, however, an important part of this is that I think Indigenous communities experience disenfranchised grief and disenfranchised loss. And, you know, speaking for myself, I've definitely experienced a major death loss recently with my grandmother, and she was my connection to my heritage, my culture, my way of understanding the world. For so many of us, those connections are, I wouldn't necessarily say lost. I don't think anything is ever lost, especially with Indigenous knowledge, because it always has a way of returning. It has that power. But sometimes when we lose connections to our communities, or when an elder passes, we experience loss in different ways, in heightened ways, or in ways that are, you know, secondary losses or compounded losses.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context of structures, big structures like settler colonialism, like the erasure of Indigenous history, which is what Thanksgiving is very much about. We have these mythologies in our public schools that the Indians and the Pilgrims came together and have a beautiful, I don't know, lunch or dinner or something, or feast. I think that that is a very strategic way of silencing Indigenous voices and suppressing the ways in which we experience grief over the loss of our, you know, our homelands, or are the delegitimization of our Indigenous knowledge in a mainstream level.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's actually, that's a perfect segue to my last question. Mm-hmm. So really, I guess, a two-part question. I'm just curious about how it is that you attend to your own mental health and wellness, and then just what the rest of this Thanksgiving week will look like for you.
Hmm. How I tend to my own mental health and wellness. So I think this also goes back to the previous question too, right? Where I think a lot of us have our own different communities and our own different, for lack of better words, traditions rather, that help remind us of who we are as individuals and as people who are part of a larger fabric, a community. So what helps me in taking care of myself is remembering my roots, remembering where I come from, that I'm the granddaughter of a farm worker who didn't have an education beyond middle school, but taught me so much about how to take care of my health in an emotional, intellectual, mental, and physical way. How to take care of myself helps me take care of others. So practicing that self-care is very important to me. So always coming back to tradition, going back to my roots, going back to people who care about me in different Indigenous communities as well helps me. I think aside from that, reading and writing definitely helps me. Reading fiction, reminding myself that taking care of myself is an act of resistance also helps me, because I think that as people of color and as Indigenous peoples, that's extremely important. And I think in our society, that our capitalistic society that says you are not worthy unless you're productive, I think that, you know, taking care of yourself is also an act of resistance. Taking naps and reminding yourself that you are worthy even when you're resting is really important. So I think those are all things that I like to do. Burning my own medicines is definitely important to me. Trying to learn my languages, which are Nahuatl and Comanche, is really important.
How far along are you?
Oh, not very far whatsoever. But it's going. And also I have, you know, my chosen family. So I think that's also important. People as students, Indigenous students and Latinx identifying students of color who also have different identities, like being queer or being trans. We all come from different backgrounds, but I think me being in community with people who are around my age, who have different shared experiences, is also very healing to me, especially now that I'm on this path in clinical social work, where self-care is extremely important and is a part of our education and training as well.
Okay. Angela, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for finding the time to visit with us today, and just, you know, enjoy the remainder of this semester, and all the best to you in your endeavors. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So despite what I said at the start of my interview with Angela, I was not actually able to schedule Holly Echo Hawk, a former member of the Hawk Foundation National Advisory Council, in time for the recording of this episode. I certainly do hope that she and I can have a conversation at some point in the future. In place of that, I thought that I would just, before I sign off here, leave you with a bit of a bonus offering. Back in 2016, the Hawk Foundation produced a short documentary called Bear Dancers that you can now find on the Foundation's YouTube page. In it, Isaac Cardenas of American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions explains the bear dance, a traditional Indigenous healing ceremony. Here's a sample.
My name is Isaac Alvarez Cardenas. I had the Healing the Wounded Spirit Mental Health Wellness Program, and also a tribal member of the Tapilan Kwawiteke Nation, and a spiritual practitioner and a mental health counselor. Sage to bless the land, this event. We have a seasonal dance called the Bear Dance. It's about healing. Again, we're going with community healing. About five-ish, get that fire going real good, six-ish, and then come in here about a little close to 8 o'clock when we see that red sun, and then we'll start with our sweat. When I had children and I made a family, I came back to these ways, you know. And I'm thankful for it. Just like my kids, they were brought up in these ways. They would sleep in a lodge like this. You know, they know about the sweat lodge. They know all about these things. So I raised them, little ones like that. But now they're men. And it's sad because I'm by myself with just me and my wife in the ceremonies. And I see other children come in, I remember, that's like my son. It's my sonny boy.
Are you excited for the sweat lodge? Or what do you think?
I don't want to go in there.
Why is that?
Too hot.
Too hot?
Mm-hmm.
It is pretty hot, no?
Mm-hmm. Huh? No, it is.
How about you, Nico? What do you think about the lodge?
It's hot. Like, in the lodge, it's hot.
Out here, it is too.
Yeah, out here, it is too.
You know, when you commit yourself to being a drummer, you're supposed to be that that energy, that extra energy that is fed to the dancers, you know? While everything's going on, you know, they're in their own world and taking on people's burdens and people's hurts and anger and frustrations, because this ceremony itself is not done just around the seasons, you know, it's done around healing. And so anytime somebody needs some specific healing, you know, somebody's dying or they're sick, you know, and they want some prayer, you know, they'll call on these bear dancers, you know, and they'll call on this drum to come out and help, you know, and help heal and carry those burdens, you know, for those people.
There was a lot of teachings that we lost. When the strangers came over, they burned their books, they burned, you know, they cut the tree down, but what they didn't do is they didn't cut it to the root. So the tree's growing back, we're rerooting, we're reconnecting all these young people.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Like I said in the intro, you can find the Bear Dancers video on the Hogg Foundation YouTube page. There is a link in the episode description. Please check it out and leave us comments. And again, don't forget, leave us a review, subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or TuneIn. Thank you for joining us.